I have been sexually rejected by not one, but two guys who later went to clown college.
You are listening to Two Magicians, One Mic.
Welcome to Two Magicians, One Mic. My name is Nick Paul, and in the studio, in our real studio for once, we have Eric Buss. How are you, Eric Buss?
I'm doing well.
Thanks for coming into my bat lair.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, I don't know if it's a studio or more of a rape cave.
That's how they have it in the office. That's on the brochure, is audio studio and rape cave.
Yes.
Depending if you've
got the egg-creating foam, so I think it's legit.
They put a couple egg-creating foams up, and then they just gave up. There's about four, five, six.
Diagonal. Although maybe that's just to muffle the sound coming in, coming out from the rape cave. So
yeah. Turn that guy around so you have the Samsung pointing towards you there.
Turn
so people
around.
Can hear you. There we go. You got the robot penis. There.
I have to hold my own mic. Top dollar, this podcast. Are we almost done?
We spare no expense. We are, I think, about 30 seconds in. So thanks, everybody. That was great. Appreciate you coming in. Eric Buss, you were kind enough to invite me to your Halloween party last year. That was fun.
Did I?
Yeah.
Did you come?
Yeah. Well, maybe you didn't know we were there.
Excellent.
But yeah.
Well, thank
you. We came during the children's section.
Oh, yes.
You did the adult section, the children's section.
Yes.
We had to get to a tour of Paramount Studios and after dark. That's why we had to leave.
Well, la-ti-da. We enjoy our Halloween party. It's moved to every other year, so you will not be invited this year because there is none.
Darn it.
Would love to have you next year, and maybe I will remember. But it's something we've tried to do. Well, we have done pretty much every year, give or take one or two. We lived in Tahoe in 2005 and we had a baby, but otherwise it'll be 12 years old when we have it next. Mm-hmm. So I believe you're at our 11th annual.
Cool. Well, I feel honored that it's
as
so
you
rare.
Should.
So how long have you been in? I mean, you have a list of credits for people that don't know. You've done basically every television show. You've done AGT, you've done Letterman, you've done Wizard Wars. You did
Not Fool Us.
Hey, me either. High five to that.
Woo!
Nice. We both got passed up for that show. I got passed up this year. I was on the hold 2 weeks before they started shooting. They're like, yeah, just keep hailing on. We're going to use you. We're going to use you. Then no.
So 2 years ago, that was me.
That was you? Yeah.
I had a conference call with the producer, the magic consultant, Johnny Thompson. We were discussing my material at length. And then it was, okay, yep, we'll figure out which trick we want, what direction, and we'll call you. And then it never came. And then I saw all my magician friends flooding to Vegas to start filming. And I went, am I supposed to be going?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Now I think I want to be the only magician on the planet who has not done Fool Us.
I was talking to Kyle Marlette about this. And he's like, by the time they're done, everybody's going to do it. So it's becoming America's Got Talent. But maybe we could talk about that because that's interesting. People always hear about success stories. And you've had certainly a lot of them. But what's it like to be in that other end of...
I've had a lot of them, meaning none of them last.
Short success stories, about 30 seconds at a time. But you've done a lot of shite. You've done, like, I was watching your Letterman appearance today. You've done Montreal's Just for Laughs. Those are hard things to get. So
yes.
What's the process of, not getting things, or after that is done, how do you come down from those things or move on?
Is there
a process?
It's a hard coming down.
That's what he said.
Exactly. Montreal was got for me. I booked Montreal through a manager that I had. My manager back in 2000 was Barry McComb. Wonderful person.
I've heard that.
Big fan of magic. And he was booking Caesar's Magical Empire in Vegas in the late 90s. And I distinctly remember he was sitting next to Milt Larson at the Magic Castle at the bar. And they had their back to me. I was merely 10 feet away, so I could hear their conversation. Well, I could hear Barry. I could hear Milt, but I don't know what he was saying. And Barry said, hey, do you know Eric Buss? I need to get a hold of him. And Milt turned around and said, he's sitting right there. And Barry went, oh, hey, Eric. And he said, hey, I love your material. I think I'd like to manage you if you're interested. And at the time, he was managing Ed Alonzo, Nicholas Knight, John Carney, and maybe one or two other acts.
Wow.
And I knew who Barry was. He had a lot of contacts. He was booking Caesars, or he had just finished booking Caesars at that point. But he was a good businessman in my business. And I was floored and shocked and amazed and excited. And I went, absolutely. And we got together for lunch and talked about it. So he managed me for a short time only because he then changed careers shortly after that, having nothing to do with me. But he did book me Montreal with my Bird Act, which I was doing from early 90s through early 2000s. Montreal was a phenomenal experience. I booked one or two gigs from that, but it was one of the biggest and first. It wasn't the first time I was on TV, but it was one of the biggest. And it was a 5,000-seat theater that was packed, also filmed for TV. And I, as a comedy fan and a comedian myself, I knew what it was long before I had performed on it. And so I knew, you know, all the big names were there. And, yeah, I'm just hanging out in the hotel lobby, you're staring at all of your comedy idols.
Wow.
Some are household names and others are just, you know, comedy names. But I was a little, I did well in the show. I had a flawless show on my own part. The audience liked me. Some of the audience loved me. Others were kind of didn't get it. I got a bad review in one of the silly reviews, but it was all silly. Like every day they in the paper, they do this kind of review of the previous night. And it's all sarcasm. And, you know, even the big names get kind of made fun of somehow, like their stupid shirt or suit they're wearing. But she didn't quite know, get my act, and she kind of thought she was ripping me apart. But at the same time, she was giving me very funny sound bites. In fact, I still remember she said it was like watching an Alfred Hitchcock film on acid. And I went, I'll take that. That's great. I don't know why she would say that about my Bird Act, because my Bird Act was cute and charming.
Yeah.
But and then, but I was mentioned there were three critics for each show, and they would each kind of talk about just a paragraph of about the show the previous night. I was mentioned in all three of them.
Hmm.
So, and two of them liked me and didn't know how I did the tricks. Then the one said, you know, it was cheesy or whatever. Don't go there, Merlin. It was bizarre. Like, she didn't even know what to say about me. Point is, though, I was mentioned all three times. The audience liked me. But in the hotel, I was by myself. I wasn't going to go, you know, to the Comedy Central after party where they're handing out Comedy Central deals. And I'm a magician with 7 minutes of material at the time. So it was really, really fun. I went to a few other shows and saw some of the best improv I've ever seen and stand up, et cetera, et cetera. Came home inspired, bought a little tape recorder to record my joke ideas in the car because I wanted to start doing more stand up at that point. And then tried to book it every year after that because it was the same booker that I met when I was there. Even though I wasn't with my manager at the time, I kept her number and info and tried to book it every year. And now it's 2017. End of story.
And that's how show business works.
Yes.
I liked what you mentioned about the castle, though, just talking to Milt Larson and your manager or pre-manager at the time was like, I need to talk to Eric Buss, and he's like, oh, he's right behind me. It's funny how that works in LA, and that was the biggest shock to me when I moved here 2 years ago. Of it's very old school in that way of, you need to talk to him? Oh, he's right over here. Oh, I know him. I'll get you his number.
Yep, out of sight, out of mind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I don't get to the castle nearly as much as I want to or should these days. I have a 5-year-old kid, which is wonderful, but, you know, unless I'm working there or the friends are working there or there's just, I kind of get the itch. I'm actually going tomorrow night after Booby Trap because I'm in Booby Trap. So that gets me out of the house. And then I get the permission from the wife to just stay out.
Sure.
Not that she's extremely supportive, but it's a bigger deal to plan a castle night.
I understand. Yeah.
And it's a bummer because, yeah, Jack books very much the people in front of his face and just the meeting people. But I can't tell you how many times I've been there over the last 2 decades that I've worked there. You know, yeah, you get a booking because you're standing right there.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you're talented and they like you, but you're there.
I spent 4 or 5 years emailing Jack before I moved here. And it wasn't until I literally not confronted him, but found him at the bar and said, hi, I'm Nick. I've been emailing you for 5 years. Oh, let me take you, give you a drink. A few months later, I had a booking. But it's, once again, it goes back to that old school way of if people are wondering how to get booked at things.
But that's unfortunate that we have to go to the castle to get booked now, and I feel bad for the people that live out of town. I mean, I go there, man, it's probably once a month these days, which is not enough at all. But now I have to go there to try to get booked. We have email, we have texting, we have cell phones, and we have which I don't want to talk smack, but I love the place, love Jack.
I love Jack, but it is a 50-50 shot if I'm going to get a return on that email I just sent him, even if it's a simple question.
Yep.
But I noticed you're wearing a Second City shirt. I am a Second City alum.
Look at that. I didn't even plan that.
Look at that. I did the conservatory in Chicago.
I did it
throw
in
that
LA.
In your face. Okay.
I did the Bastard Stepchild one. I believe it's the same education.
Yes, same
somewhat.
Philosophy.
Maybe just less passionate students or teachers. I don't know. My teachers were all very passionate. The students I was in the classes with, I am.
Well, it's kind of similar in many ways in Chicago too, because I love Second City. I've learned I owe a lot to it, but
as do I.
They do sell this dream, even if they don't say it to your face. They do say, "Hey, you take our classes and you're going to be on Saturday Night Live." That is not word for word, but that is the subtext of what they're selling, and a lot of people show up.
Right.
Who are ill prepared or shouldn't be there, or I mean, everybody should take an improv class. Everybody should learn how to improvise, whether you're in business.
That's why
or
you're a good yes ander, both with texting, Facebook, and in person.
I was just going to say that we're both very. I can always tell a fellow improviser because
and
you
can
go
tell
back and forth.
Somebody that I actually enjoy talking to and hanging out with. It is shocking how I was walking my dog, thinking, "I swear to you, this is true." I'm wearing my Second City shirt. I wonder if Nick will bring that up. I wonder if we'll talk about yes-anding. I'm going to tell Nick that I like him because he yes-ands me.
That's very kind of you.
And I'm also going to tell him how nobody else, or not nobody, but how so few magicians know how to do it.
I think that's a magic trait, though, too, because we are, a note I got from a teacher at Second City was do more group shows. Because you are so used to doing solo work that it's a problem for you.
Yeah. Yep.
You notice that a lot with a lot of magicians of.
But even daily talking at lunch, where you're not on a show or a stage, and you say something that's not you're not going for the laugh, but you say something that hopefully they bat it back to you, and you keep it going in a funny conversation, quirky conversation, and so often it just goes.
Yeah.
And you're like,
well, I did this, and then the conversation drops.
But my second level, my level two, which is character teacher, who I'm still friends with now, and her husband, Mike Ross, is my graphic designer. Amy Seeley sat us all down, and I was really struggling in level one. I sucked. I was one of the worst improvisers in my whole level one class, but I was the only one making a career at that moment of performing.
It was the same way.
It was a bizarre juxtaposition. And when I joined, I said, I am not talking magic. I'm not a magician. I'm not going to bring it up. I'm not going to brag. I want to be a beginner improviser. I want to learn from the beginning. I don't want to skip anything. I don't want them to say, oh, you do magic. You can just go, you know. So I joined with that in mind. Level one, I sucked all the way through. I had very few good moments throughout the classes. Level two, character, I really started to get better because characters helped me kind of just lose myself and be able to be in the moment better. But it was Amy Seeley, who we're all sitting down. She says, Eric, what do you do for a living? And I said, I'm a magician. And she said, full-time professional magician? I said, yeah. And she went, oh, that makes so much sense. Mm-hmm. That's why you're thinking too much, and that's why you're in your head choreographing what your next move is. Because as a magician, you have to do that. You have to have all your props in order, and you have to know what you're doing beginning, middle, and end. And you're doing that now in improv, and you can't do that in improv. And so she helped me kind of get over that hump. And but in addition to that, she was one of the best teachers in Hollywood Second City. She's no longer there, but she was one of the best. Also, coincidentally, I think character level just helped me in general.
Sure.
But also, I did really well with strict teachers. And level one, students wearing flip-flops, chewing gum in a scene. You know, one guy always had his freaking Bluetooth earpiece in his ear. Like, on stage, in a scene.
Who is calling you?
It should be on silent. And you take it out. They're going to leave a voicemail. Or get out of Second City. Chewing gum on stage, flip-flops, like you can't move. And then for our big shows, people are just wearing crappy clothes. And I'm going, come on, I thought we were either going to all match or all just look nice. No flip-flops, nice long pants, shoes so you can move around. How do you play a military character if you're in flip-flops? You know, and it just, but there were only a few teachers that really were militant about it. And I started kind of becoming this like brown-nosing student going, hey, can we do this? And can I do, you know, and I just, so a lot of my student, my friends or a lot of my classmates actually didn't like me for the first few years. or not years, but the first few levels.
Levels.
And then level four, when it was sketch writing, I really started shining because I did know how to think funny in the future, and I really had good ideas. And so when they were saying, now I'm just bragging, but they said, you know, bring in a sketch tomorrow, should be about 4 pages in length. Page two or page one, figure out who, why, when, where, what. Page two, you figure out the game. Page three, the game heightens. And game four, you know, maybe a twist and this and that and character relationship. And they said, bring in a sketch each Monday or whatever it was. And I was bringing in like two or three. And the people that were bringing them in had them loosely typed out, you know, and mine was in script format with everyone highlighted. And I would say, here's your part, here's your part, here's your part. Their lines are highlighted. So when we are performing it for the first time, we can sell it to the teacher, figuratively, of course, sell it, go, hey, this is what it is. And, you know, if other people butcher your sketch, you're not going to sell it to the class, and we're not going to be excited about it. But if we nail it on that first time, people go, I get it. We should keep this and work with it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was doing that and bringing in a lot of sketches. And then after a while, I started going, you know what? Fuck everyone else. Like, they're not taking this seriously. That's their problem, not mine. And I made a few close friends that really respected me, that I respected their work. And we are still friends now on Facebook. One of them moved back to Chicago. But a few of them you'd see in commercials, you know, they're all working. And then the rest who didn't take it seriously, I don't know. They're not in this business, and I don't know where they are.
Yeah.
But the best moment from purely ego standpoint was I got Letterman during our level five show. And level five show is you write your sketch show, you rehearse it for months and months, and then you do it 4 Fridays in a row. Ours happened to be October 2007. I did Letterman October 12th, and I got to film Letterman on a Monday, and they aired it on a Friday because Letterman wants 3-day weekends, so he films his Friday show on Monday. We did our Second City show Friday night at 8 p.m. One of my friends in the class said at the end of the show, Eric Buss is on Letterman tonight. Go home and watch him. And I was like, yep. So booking Letterman while I was at Second City, and we had two arrogant pricks in that class that joined late and nobody liked them, and I could just kind of, you know, do an F you to them. That was a really nice ego moment. But it was Amy Seeley and Mike Ross and a handful of others that really were good, strong teachers that were passionate and that were militant and got it.
I had the same thing. I had a teacher by the name of Michael Gelman. He's kind of a you know, ominous figure in Toronto and Chicago, Second City, and the same thing, very strict, but I always identified with him because I understood the structure and I understood what he was trying to get to, and a lot of people thought he was a hard ass and didn't like him, but I took that as an advantage. I'm like, oh, and you need this. You need the structure in this chaos.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so, I agree.
That's wild. That's funny that,
and we're not high school students. Thing. Like, you could quit at any moment. You know he's not doing it personally towards you, so why not have a really good, strict teacher?
Yeah, and you paid to be there. Exactly. You paid to learn something.
Right.
And, yeah, I don't know. I think that just improv in general in L.A. is so funny. It's because when I was in Chicago, Second City is such a juggernaut. You come here, UCB's the juggernaut, and a lot of people don't even know of Second City or even I.O., which is still fairly busy anytime I've been there. But, it's just a whole different realm of thought and comedy and sketch and
yeah,
whole different game out here.
Yeah.
Bringing back to entertaining, and you, I usually save this for a little bit, but I'll go into it now. What is a best gig experience? What is your worst gig experience? You don't have to have answers for both, but I'm always curious if anything.
I got a
like
lot of worst. Like yeah. We could just talk about that all day
You've
long.
Been Those in the game for a while, yeah. Maybe your two favorite worst.
Well, Montreal was one of the best, just because it was Montreal and it was a beautiful stage, and I used that footage for years. And I got photos with famous people. I shared a dressing room with John Panette. I was shocked that they put the headliner, John Panette, in with the opening act, Eric Buss. That blew me away. And I had Doves and a Rabbit. But he was very nice.
I miss him.
Yeah, me too. So Montreal, one of the best. David Letterman, still by far the best. It was just a well-oiled machine. They treated me like royalty, and it was just phenomenal. And I was, you know, number one on his top 10 list, and he had talked about the Spring Snakes all throughout the episode. He was talking about me throughout the episode.
The bit he did at the beginning with just the peanuts is amazing. Exactly. What a great lead-in.
And, you know, I had magicians tell me, like, oh, I treated you so poorly. And I went, no.
It's Letterman.
He got it. It's Letterman. Letterman and Leno both got my video roughly the same day, if not, you know, a few days before and after. I sent my video to everyone. Letterman said yes. Leno said no. Which one is the jerk? Now, I'm not saying Leno's a jerk, but I'm going to be partial for Letterman for the rest of my life.
Sure.
Yes, it's Letterman. He is snarky and sarcastic, but he got it. I mean, my spring snake routine is ridiculous, but he loved it. He stood up for it. He gave me a standing ovation, called it sensational, beautiful, tremendous. Yeah, he was making fun of the premise beforehand because we hadn't seen it yet, and it worked. And then afterwards, he continued to talk about how cool it was, saying, man, that was a crowd pleaser, wasn't it? And he kept showing footage, and it just worked, and it was just such a wonderful experience. But also, you know, that night we partied in New York, and it was phenomenal. And I could talk a whole lot about Letterman, but those two were probably the best. The worst, man, I bombed at Bellingham, Washington, at a comedy club. And it's weird because while I was setting up, the manager of it was a bar. It was a one-nighter. So the manager of the bar doesn't know much about the comedy show because the comedy show is booked by an outside agent. We just show up and do a show, and they turn on the microphone. So she didn't really know anything. And she said, oh, what are you doing? And I said, oh, I'm setting up some props. And she said, well, are you a comedian? I said, well, I'm a magician and a comedian. She said, you're a magician? Well, are you funny? And I said, yeah. She's like, oh, okay, well, we haven't had a magician before. Okay, great. You know, set up and see you later. Then two frat boys, like, pop through the front door. It's getting closer to showtime, about 5 p.m., and they come in. They're a little obnoxious, but they're like, oh, are you in the show? Oh, cool, we're going to come. Hey, man, are you funny? And I said, yeah, come on back to the show at 8. And I thought, that's the second person. Why am I being asked if I'm funny twice today? So the show starts, and they're a pretty tough crowd for the first act, and I'm introduced, and first trick, second trick, I decide, it's my pogo stick, I bring a girl on stage, I decide to bring up the bachelorette from a little bachelorette party.
Oh boy.
Thinking, here's my rationale, thinking, well, I'll get her 7 friends on my side, because they're going to see their friend on stage. And I don't do any, like, major, you know, flirty jokes, or it's not even that big a deal. I could bring up anyone and do the trick. I brought her up, and I had their attention for about 2 minutes, the bachelorette party. And then while I'm on the pogo stick, I try to kiss the girl. Now, we're talking, I'm 3 feet away, but I'm just making kissy lips and bouncing closer to them. It's really silly and stupid. I shouldn't be that big of a threat. She reacted as if I had leprosy. She backed away from me with her hands up, you know, giving me like the cross of a vampire, you know, because I was trying to pretend like I was kissing her. And I thought to myself at that moment, like, am I that ugly? I thought I was like an okay guy, and I'm clearly a silly magician. She's really that threatened. Anyway, finish the trick. She goes back. I quickly lose the bachelorette party. They're just drunk and chatty. And I start to lose everyone in the audience, and they're just chatty and drunk, and they're not paying attention. And I finally get to Kate and Edith, that poem by Carey Pollack with the cards. And it's all rhyming, so it's kind of structured, and you have to kind of remember the script. And in the middle of a pause, I hear somebody from the back row say, "Go home!" Oh, and I just kind of like close my eyes and just tense up. And I said, believe me, I cannot wait. And I just quickly finished that routine, threw it in my table, did my closing trick, threw it in my table, said thank you, good night, walked off stage, very little applause. And the next guy, no, the headliner that night, he said, and I learned something. I mean, you know, I've bombed more recently than that, so it taught me something, but still something difficult to achieve all the time. But he said, man, you guys don't know what you want. You didn't like the first act. You hated Mr. Magic. And he said that, quote, on stage. And he was right. And he said, well, let me tell you something. I've performed in Harlem. I've performed for the troops in Iraq. You guys don't scare me one bit.
Nice.
Here comes the first joke. And from then on, he had their attention. And they were a fickle college crowd where, sure, you know, they're too cool to laugh at goofy stuff. But I thought, man, what a great confidence that guy has.
That's awesome.
And then when I got my sound equipment from the sound man, he barely looked at me in my eye. The manager didn't look at me when I left, literally leaving with my tail between my legs, and got the hell out and drove
as
fast as I
could. That's
the worst,
when either the person that hired you or someone associated with that doesn't say anything to you. That, yep. I mean, the audience is one thing.
Sure.
But for them to come up and go, oh, no, they were bad. But
yeah,
just,
no, it sucked.
I had to do it one time where I just bombed in this banquet room, and I had the only way out with all my shit was through right. the audience, yeah. like a 200-foot walk, and I had to do it twice because I had so much stuff.
Yep.
Oh, man. It was awful. And you had a second one? Was there
I have dozens. How long do you want to be here? The other one was right down the street. It was at an Orthodox Jewish temple.
Say no more.
Yep, exactly.
No judgments.
End
all God's
story.
Children.
My wife is Reformed Jew. I'll just say that.
There you
She's
go.
She's Reformed Jew.
I had many tough audiences when I lived in Florida. Were yeah. Very Orthodox Jewish. They were very either talkative or didn't know there was entertainment or just weren't.
When I
tough.
Got there, they did give me a private room to set up in, and there was a window that I could look into. Let's call it a lobby. And they had kids running around on the big folding tables. The big banquet tables, they were jumping from table to table, running on all of them.
It's not like those fold or anything.
Yeah, exactly. And I thought, why is that acceptable anywhere? A, for danger, and B, like, get your kids' feet off the damn table. And there were adults in there completely ignoring them. And I went, okay, so these kids are entitled. Why, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And then the rabbi brought me into the room where the event was, and I said, do you have any tape? We can just tape a little half circle on the floor to give me a little bit of a stage so the kids can come up to the line. Adults are, of course, going to sit in the back. And he's like, no, we don't have any tape. Well, luckily, I have a trick that involves masking tape, and it's a blue masking tape. And I went, well, damn it, I forgot. I have my own tape. I taped my own stage, knowing he wasn't going to help me. I taped my own stage, and which, foreshadowing, didn't matter at all where my stage was because the kids crept over it. He also had a speaker with one input. And now we may have discussed this before. Maybe we didn't because I've never run into this problem. One input. I could choose microphone or music. I chose music because I figured, well, it's a small room, I can project, and music does drive my show. In retrospect, I probably should have chosen microphone, although it would not have mattered because they were filling any silence with their own voice, creeping over the tape, literally at my shins, at my feet, and I'm doing a pogo stick trick. I'm acting like I'm falling on top of them, like nothing. They wanted to fill the space and just get on top of me. And then when I'm trying to talk to the adults in the back, they were all on their phones, all talking, all scrolling through Facebook. And I literally at one point said, you know, something like, adults, if somebody could select a card from the I was doing Chris Mitchell's Cards in the Bucket, long distance card trick, tossed out deck. And I said, if an adult can reach into the bucket and pull out the deck, if they want to show a good example for their children and pay attention and not be on their phones, and like literally just a pair of eyes, you know, would pop up from their phone, maybe two pair, and they'd reluctantly go along with it. And I closed with Cardiographic, which is a routine that I do with a bunch of different drawings of a very, very expensive card trick that I've, you know, invented. It's all fiction. It's all silly. But at one point, I have a beautiful Brazilian supermodel. It's a drawing. I am a terrible drawer. It's a drawing with markers of a woman in a dress. And he had asked me before the show, do you have any music with female lyrics, female singing? Because they don't allow that because they're Orthodox Jews and stupid. So I said, no, I don't have any female lyrics in my show. And I thought about it and I didn't. Well, I didn't even think about this drawing because I'm not stupid. And that's why I didn't even think about this drawing because I've done it for 5-year-olds.
Yeah.
And no big deal. Well, I flipped to this page and the rabbi who's standing 5 feet away from me while I'm performing, standing 5 feet away from me on the stage, just basically waiting for me to be done. Didn't want to bother sitting down. he starts to say, he sees the, Eric, you, that, we can't have the, can you, flip that page? While I'm doing my script, he is freaking out. And rather than really letting him have it and explaining my point of view of the world, I just went, Eric, get out of here as fast as possible.
Sure.
I quickly flipped the page. I kept going, flip the page, flip the page, flip the page. Card rises out of the deck. Nobody gives a shit. I hand the piece of paper to a kid. They all shred it because they all want one piece of it. Thank you. Good night. And he wasn't too upset about that. And I said, you know, I'm sorry about the drawing of the woman. I may have even been sarcastic when I said sorry. But he's, oh, you know, no big deal. But I just couldn't have him. And I said, okay, no problem. So he gives me the check. I leave the next day for a gig for a week. So my plan to go home is spend time with my wife. Pack up at the show. Go home. All my props are in my truck, ready to go to the airport. No big deal. Well, these kids are attacking me, literally, like coming inches from my table with all not only the secrets but just expensive props. And I decide I can't pack up in this room. These kids are not going to allow it. I bear hugged my table, picked it up, which was at least 50 pounds of very awkward weight, and I shuffled it out to my car, threw it into the back of my truck, slammed the tailgate, and I was trying to pull out of this really awkward parking lot, and just I pulled out and all of my props were just upside down when I left the place because I just had to get the hell out. And as I was leaving, I started having the worst thoughts in my head, which I will not mention, but they were such a terrible audience and terrible gig. And I went home and told my wife about it, and she kind of nodded her head going, yeah, they're a lot of times they're entitled, and let me guess, the boys were entitled, not the women, not the girls. Yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm. And I have so many problems with fundamentalist religions, but we won't talk about that. But just so happens, it's also one of the
all
top
God's
five.
Children.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
No, you don't have to tell me twice. I know, and I've done so many great Jewish events here in LA where everybody's been wonderful and nice.
Of
but
course.
Orthodox, you're. If I haven't gotten a call for one in a while, thank God. But
nor have I.
I don't know if I would take it.
No,
because I've been through just a handful of terrible ones.
Right, and that not to get political, but the whole, you know, bakers baking a cake for a gay wedding. I think can't the bakers just say no, I'm booked that day, and not mention their religious beliefs, and then everyone goes away fine.
Yeah,
and I'm a liberal. I agree with the gays, but still, like, you don't want their cake.
Mm-hmm.
And if an Orthodox calls me and says that we're an Orthodox temple and it's a Purim event or any Hanukkah event, I'm going to say, I'm booked.
Yeah, I've learned that's the best thing to say because nobody's, oh, he's busy. He's
right.
He's clearly doing well.
Exactly.
Even if your calendar is wide open.
Right. It shouldn't be a law thing. It shouldn't be that difficult. I'm just not going to take it. Specifically,
sure.
Because they're Orthodox, yes, but they won't know that.
Well, they will now because
yeah,
they
exactly.
Clearly, everybody
I'm
listens
so
to this
gonna get emails from this podcast.
Angry emails from Orthodox Jewish magicians.
Mm, a lot of them.
What would you pursue if you weren't a magician?
I moved out here with big dreams of, you know, hosting my own late night talk show and being a film actor and TV actor. I haven't pursued the work that is involved with getting those venues, so I don't deserve those things. However, if somebody were to hand something to me, I would work my ass off on making it as best I could. You know, always my problem with the acting business, and I've tried. I have a commercial agent. I did Second City. I've been going to auditions since I've been living here for 19 years.
Wow.
I've always hated getting the work, but then once I get the work, I will work 18-hour days, no complaints, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
Let's all be creative all day long and all night.
Sure.
Yes. But to go to the audition and just be stared at by, you know, casting directors and all of that crap, I hated it. And I realized only recently that, A, you have to enjoy that part of the job to pursue it because it's a major part of the job.
Mm-hmm.
Also, when I'm out on the road doing magic shows, whether it's on a cruise ship, corporate fair, anywhere, if I'm doing magic shows, I'm not thinking about acting. I'm not thinking about going out on auditions. I am perfectly happy just doing magic shows. My auditioning and my acting bug, or my need to do all of that stuff, only would pop up when I was in LA not doing shows and bored. Mm. And then I start seeing friends on TV in a commercial, or even not friends, but I go, oh, that was a funny commercial. That would have been a fun one to do. You know, I wonder how my commercial agent's doing. I will call them. I only think of that stuff when I'm home not working.
Yeah.
And now if I'm not working, I'm in my garage building crap, which also makes me perfectly content. So I have a commercial agent. He knows I'm a magician. He's seen me at the castle. He loves me. He knows he sends me out once a month, and I'm fine with that. I do my best when I go. In fact, he did finally, I booked a commercial through them, and it was this credit card commercial that a bunch of people saw me on, where I was dressed as a giant credit card, and I did a magic trick. And it was the most fun audition I've ever done. It was the most fun callback I've ever done. And then I booked it. And it was a great day. It was a full day, 12 hours, 16 hours. But it was in North Hollywood, right down the street. I loved it. And I thought, I do like this. But unfortunately, most auditions mm-hmm. are insulting to my intelligence, and I don't enjoy them at all.
Bryan Cranston was talking about this in his new book of how you have to treat an audition not even just like you need to book the job, just as a performance in itself. And yeah. the second you finish, you leave, and it's completely out of your mind. You're done.
I agree 100%. It's much easier said than done.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
And he did a little quip. He did a bit talking about that exact same thing. He was interviewed, but it was a quick little, I don't know, inspirational video. Maybe it was just for YouTube or Facebook, the same thing. You know, you can't think of what you can't try to be what they want. They don't even know what they want yet.
Sure.
And you can't do that. You have to go in and bring yourself and sell yourself. And if they don't need you, then they don't need you.
Yeah. And that, and you have to love that process. You have to love going through that whole thing and showing up in a room of 50 people that look exactly like you and knowing not get too much in your head.
Right. And I've enjoyed a handful of them, but most of them, they end up being kind of dumb. Some casting directors are very friendly and are having fun. Many are not. And I never enjoyed it. That said, when I started off trying to audition and do magic, I thought, if I get rejected through acting, it's easy because they're not rejecting me per se. They're rejecting, I did the script that they wrote and they don't need me. Mm-hmm. They need somebody who's taller, shorter, whatever.
Sure.
Whereas if I get rejected with my magic act and it's the act I created, that is a little bit more personal and it hurts a little bit more. So I could go into auditions and not give a shit for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And then just they start piling up of, you know, rejections or not getting called back. And it does start to wear and tear a little bit. But again, I'm happy with my magic career right now and I'm very busy. And so if I'm home and my commercial agent gets me an audition, it's funny because I look at it and I'm like, oh man, tomorrow. And I say, Eric, you're not busy tomorrow. Go to it and go to it and have fun and try hard. Mm-hmm. And I go, okay, I will. You know, I'll dress accordingly and I will look clean cut and I will go do it to the best of my ability, wherever it is in town, and then I will come home and go right back to building magic tricks or booking shows.
I think, another element of acting, too, is you don't get this piece of the puzzle when you're a magician or when you're doing a magic show. You're affecting people in some emotional way or some hopefully positive way where they get to take that with them. But because so many people are acting and there's so many acting opportunities, especially in this town, that it's almost lost, I think, on the casting director, is lost on the person auditioning. Yep. Of just you, the whole point is, you know, to affect other people and to get something out of it. And it's much harder to a much harder hill to climb,
especially when they're commercials.
Yeah.
And because I'm still non-union after 19 years, again, because I haven't really even tried. So that's even worse that I'm not booking SAG commercials. But yeah, it's hard to get really passionate about it when it's a non-union commercial. That said, a good friend of mine, Dylan Terrison, who I went to college with, he's been producing films out here for years. He started off producing shitty films, and now he has a front-end credit co-producer on Hell or High Water with Jeff Bridges. And it got nominated for Oscars. It's one of his first biggest, most successful movies he's been a part of. And he's working for a big company, but he's also doing, you know, he's producing. And I did audition for the televangelist in that movie. When Jeff Bridges and the other guy, I forgot his name, are in the cheap hotel room, motel room, there is a televangelist on the TV. And the guy who did get it looks great, and I went, oh, that's the way they went. But I did get to audition for that. It was different, though. I made my own video at home of me delivering their religious script, and I sent it in. It was, I mean, it was Dylan handing me the this audition. It was not, I did not get it in any other way, and I know this. I did not book it, but it was a fun, very fun audition, because it did take a little creativity on my part. I got to be a, you know, a pastor, a minister on TV, and I spent all day working on this kind of, I put a set together or a little gray curtain behind me, memorized the script, really thought about which direction I wanted to take it, and I took it a little bit more loving and passionate, and the guy that they did have in it was yelling and, you know, you need to be saved, and, you know, so they went that direction, but it was really fun to do. But those auditions are very few and far between, so there you go. There's my acting world.
Yeah.
Non-existent.
I guess we've talked about this a little bit. What are your influences outside of magic?
Most of them are comedy-based. You know, Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert and Steve Martin, and I love Louis C.K. these days and all those guys. I'm also very inspired by Neil deGrasse Tyson. Of course, then again, nowadays he's famous. Who's not? You know, they all love him. Mythbusters, I love those guys.
Because a lot of your stuff is, I mean, your tag is inventive comedy magic. Is that something you stumbled upon, or is that something you've kind of always had with you?
Both. Years ago, I was trying to, actually, it was right after Letterman, where I decided I need to up everything. I need to up my logo, my brand, my website, my promotional materials, everything. I've done Letterman now. I have to use this. And it was right after that where I was trying to find a new title and brand. And I had a list of 30 of them, of everything from Comedy Imaginator, which is what I ended up going with back then, to Hyper Techno Comic, which my good friend Jeff Williams came up with. Just all sorts of weird titles that I was trying to get away from magic as well, just because I had numerous agents and managers tell me, you know, you are different than magicians. You should set yourself apart from magicians. So I came up with Comedy Imaginator, and I had friends, respected friends, and agents, and people that I worked with and trusted, vote. And Comedy Imaginator won, hands down, from our top five. So I created everything, website, video, with Comedy Imaginator. Then within the copy, within the like my bio, it mentions magic and, you know, magic tricks and all this stuff. But Comedy Imaginator was by itself. And then over the course of a few years, other people would say, so what? What is a comedy imaginator? And I, as soon as I would say I'm a magician, they go, oh, okay.
Yeah.
And I went, people need a category, and they need me to be in a category. Whether I like it or not, I should probably stick to the category that I'm in. Because comedy imaginator or comedy magician, 95% of what I do is magic.
Mm-hmm.
So I am a magician. You know, I have been since I was 16. I can't get away from that, nor should I want to get away from that. So it was after that, then I think I changed to, well, I think it was still like inventive comedy and magic. But yeah, then I've changed kind of logos a little bit since then. But so inventive comedy and magic is me sticking with what I do and spoon feeding it for corporate buyers or anyone who might not know, you know, all these words together, what they mean. So if their boss says, hey, find a magician for the big Christmas party, they're going to look up magicians, and mine should say comedy and magic on it.
Mm.
Inventive is, yes, everything I do is inventive. And I also call myself a bit of a, you know, an amateur inventor. So inventive, the word works. But yeah, it was a long time to find all that. And it seems silly because inventive comedy and magic isn't that original of words or any sort of brand, but it is exactly what I do.
It's very specific. And, yeah, you know,
and it is specific.
It paints a picture of exactly what you do.
Yeah, and my graphic designer, Mike Ross, who was my former Second City teacher, he was the one that kind of came up with my newest logo, new website, and all this stuff. And yeah, I've always been fascinated with kind of gears, mechanical devices, Rube Goldberg machines. And I started kind of combining the two. And again, it kind of started with the spring snakes because I built this thing that wasn't magic and it was a giant contraption that entertained people. And I thought, well, that's kind of fun. I want to do that more. But even the routines I do that aren't a contraption, like my Velcro routine where I kind of paint a picture of a picture using Velcro pieces. It's not a contraption, but I do talk about my obsession with Velcro. And anyone who knows me knows I have an obsession with Velcro. It is a far underrated, however, it is well used, invention, but it's a cool story of how it was invented and this and that. And, so everything I do, I want to have a bit of kind of that workshoppy feel or that, you know, inventor feel. Another thing I talk about my kid, and we're teaching him how to read with alphabet cards, flashcards, but they all end up stuck on a big piece of tape. It's almost like a visual, a vertical ribbon spread of cards. They stick on the tape for a display. And again, I don't shove it down the audience's throat of, look, I'm using painting tape because I like to do things in my workshop. But they get it. They see me bring out the tape, and it's kind of an inventive way to display cards on a stage.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of my rule for myself. You know, if I come up with a new idea, I really want it to be me, and I want it to have some sort of inventive twist to it, whether or not it's something I invent or it's something like a screwdriver, but people would understand why it's in my show, why sure. I'm using it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
I think so, yeah. Yeah. As we come to the wrap up here, we're at 46 minutes.
Just getting started.
We can keep going. You're the one who has a child to pick up.
No, I don't have to pick him up till 4. That's I thought we were true. Drinking scotch in here, too. Where's the scotch?
Somebody stole it. Damn. I had a whole bunch of Glenlivet here, too. I actually have to go meet, you know, David Kovac.
I know the name.
Yeah. Well, anyway, we're doing the Magic Castle next week, and we're trying to write our show, and it's not written yet.
So. Yeah, plenty of time. Are you in the pillar?
Got a week. Yeah.
Nice.
It's so hard to write a two-man show when you're not used to doing mm-hmm. two-man shows together.
Yep.
I'll end with this question here. Do you have any advice to magicians, professional or hobbyist magicians, anyone out, any advice that you've learned over your years of snakes and Letterman and things like that,
that
you could give to the people?
It's funny because it's the same advice that anyone gives. And as a young magician, you hear the advice and it just sounds so canned and forced. And then when you get to be older, you realize it's good advice. And it's kind of just to take every magic show you can, perform as often as you can, blah, blah, blah. They've yeah. heard that. I mean, I could come up with some more advice as well, but that's number one. I'm having a hard time with... I'm 42, and magic is not the way it used to be when I started, and it's not to climb the ranks in the magic world is different than when I started as well. You know, when I started, you kind of competed at magic conventions, and then from there, maybe you booked some other magic conventions, and you started to book real-world work as well. But for me, my idols were Lance Burton and, you know, Greg Frewin and all the bird acts that had a competition act. And then I one day wanted to be a bird act in a review show in Vegas or a full Vegas show or this and that, travel Europe and do the TV shows, blah, blah, blah. And all of that has changed so much that nowadays it's like kids are now YouTube stars. And they may or may not do real live magic in for audiences in theaters, but they're certainly not competing in magic contests anymore. And maybe they shouldn't be. I'm not saying that they should go back and do that. I'm saying that it's the whole thing has changed. But I'm still kind of trying to wrap my head around this. There's been a lot of young magicians that have moved to LA that I just don't know about. And then all of a sudden, not only do I know their names, but they're working... They seem to be working as much as me and around the world, and they're big names and doing this and that. And I'm going, well, how old are you? How did you get started? And what did you how come I have never heard of you? And it's bizarre. It's only started happening within the last 5 to 7 years. And I feel like before that, I kind of knew most of the magicians at level 1, level 2, mm-hmm. level 3. And then, of course, your Lance Burtons, your David Copperfields at level 10. But it's I'm still trying to figure it out, which is why exactly when we saw each other this morning, I said, how old are you and how long have you lived in L.A.? Where did you come from?
Yeah, I think
and it's exciting. It's an exciting time, and I love seeing the younger magicians that are super talented. And I'm 42. I can say younger. You're much younger than me.
Not that far apart.
No, but 12 years.
You want to piss off a whole bunch of people on Facebook? Say you're turning 30 and somebody called you sir. Everybody over the age of 40 gets mad at you.
Uh-huh, exactly.
I was just making a joke. I'm like, I'm thrilled to be 30. I've been perpetually 45 my whole life, so I'm thrilled about this.
And as a comedy magician, I couldn't wait. In fact, years ago, I was working with a bunch of my idols at the time. I don't even remember who they were. People we've all heard of, just at magic conventions, though. And I started asking everyone's age. They were all 38 at the time. I was 25 at the time. And I thought, okay, 38, that's the magic number. I got to make it to 38, and when I get to 38, I should be at the top of my game. But if I'm not at the top of my game, at least I'll know if I should continue because I will be doing hopefully as well as they are or just around where they are. You know, it just became this kind of this arbitrary age of success. Whether it was right or wrong didn't matter. And then when I got to 38, I realized a bunch of my newer idols or peers and friends were like 45 and really hitting their stride or even older than that. And I went, okay, 45. All right. I'm going to get to 45. And now I'm 42. I had success at age 38. I had success at age 25. I had success at age 20. Hopefully I will have success at age 48 at 50. And I'm just now learning that it just is, you know, it's life. Mm-hmm. Do your thing and do your best and be a good person and,
Yeah, that's such a great, another great lesson about living in LA too. It's like you see people who have done serious shit and you still feel like, you're like, oh, they did this crazy thing, but we're still in a weird way all on the same level in a good way.
Yep.
So I think you just have to be, exist in the moment, happy with what comes your way and know that you're going to have highs and you're going to have lows. Yep.
Yeah, my advice would be enjoy your current gig and then think about future gigs as well.
That's good.
Do not enjoy your current gig, and don't ignore future gigs.
Yeah.
Because I see so many young guys trying to skip ahead somehow, or they're not having fun at the current gig because they're thinking about another gig, or the opposite, and you kind of say, no, you're doing this right now.
Mm-hmm.
Enjoy this crappy gig because you booked it, or this wonderful gig because you booked it. In fact, do we have a few minutes or should I shut up?
Keep going, man.
I have to pick up my kid at 4. Okay. Live 3 minutes from my house. I'm not going to keep you from your big brainstorm session.
We'll go another 10 minutes or so if that's cool.
But no, when I did Letterman, I asked 3 comedians who I'd known had done Letterman advice. And one was Orny Adams, who I'd worked with at Comedy Magic Club.
Yeah, he's great. I know him.
Yep. I'd worked with him at Ice House. I asked Jim Brogan. I had worked with him at Comedy and Magic Club. He's former executive producer and head writer of The Tonight Show with Leno years ago. He is a very big deal. And I asked Patton Oswalt. Now, I'm not trying to drop a name. I met him briefly at the Magic Castle. He had not seen my show, but I just told him I was a big fan. And then I happened to see him on Facebook and I was able to say, hey, I met you at the Magic Castle last night. So at least he knew I wasn't some stalker. I'm about to do Letterman. So again, he knew I was serious.
Legitimate.
Any advice you can give? I asked Orny Adams, Jim Brogan, and Patton Oswalt advice on Letterman. They all 3 said the exact same thing in completely different ways. Orny Adams said something to the effect of, have fun. You already booked the gig. Don't forget to have fun. Jim Brogan said something like, just have fun. And Patton Oswalt, and I might be mixing up who said what, but Patton Oswalt said something like, have fun, you're the only one on that show that night, it's all about you.
Ooh.
Like, there's not going to be another magician on the same show, there's not going to be another stand-up comedian on the same show, there's not going to be, certainly not going to be a guy shooting spring snakes at the same time, it's all about you, have fun. You know, you already booked the gig, forget about competition, forget about challenge, and have fun. And all three of them said, have fun. So when my wife and I flew out there, her job, her only job the whole day, well, she helped stuff snakes as well, but her other job.
I hope so.
At the very last minute, at the lastest minute she could possibly do it before I go into the private studio area, you know, where I'm just handled by stage managers, her job was to tell, remind me to have fun. And I swear to you, when I was leaving the green room where she had to stay, she told me, she said, don't forget to have fun. And it literally was like I hadn't even considered it. Mm-hmm. She literally reminded me.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, yeah, yeah, sweetie, I got this. It was, oh, yeah, thanks.
Yeah.
And I walked out going, oh, yeah, this is going to be fun.
Sure.
And it was an amazing experience with that segue. But so that's also advice, you know, have fun. And that comes from much bigger people than me. But that is the whole point of what we're doing, and the audience can read it. And if you're not having fun, and I have been guilty many times of not having fun during this show or that show, sometimes you can't turn it around, but sometimes you can. And if you're not having fun, it will read, the audience will see it. They will not have fun. And it is a terrible cycle, and it's a terrible downward spiral from mm-hmm. there, whether it's just in that show or it's your entire career. So yeah, that would be advice as well, but that also seems kind of like a given, but I don't know.
It is, but it's something. It's same exact thing. I mean, I was doing a ship this week, and it was a ship I haven't been on in a while, and it was something I was like, I need to knock out of the park because I want to keep doing this particular gig. And yeah, my wife was backstage, same thing. She's like, just have fun. And same revelation of, didn't even think of that, didn't even consider
oh,
it.
Right.
I'm too busy thinking about what's in my pockets or uh-huh. is the whole show set up. I'm thinking about just like having a big piece of paper that either says "don't give a fuck" or just have fun. One of the, or
don't
maybe
give
just
a fuck
both.
Is great as well.
In a positive, not in a course, not in course. A f all of you, nope. but in a who cares?
I'm gonna do my thing, and you can enjoy it and come along with me or not.
Yeah.
And I've had a handful of moments. Still, not nearly enough. I want more, and I don't. I'm still struggling to find more, but the not giving a fuck moments are some of the best moments on stage.
Yeah.
And Matt King, I think, as well, said that same thing to me somewhere, convention or something. And it was, yeah. Again, it's not in a negative way. It's very positive, but don't mm-hmm. take yourself too seriously. Don't take it personally. Don't take their response personally. And we've all done the show where we think the audience sucks. Then we get a ton of compliments afterwards. Or one guy, you're staring at the one person not laughing throughout the whole show, or they looked bored. And then afterwards, they're the one that comes up and says, oh, my God, you were so great. My wife died 2 months ago or something. And and it just slams you back to earth going, oh, yeah, I'm mm-hmm. not supposed to be here for me.
I've had to learn not to get angry. And I've talked about this in the podcast, too, just not getting angry at quiet audiences. It's like, oh, maybe they're just all processing this in a different way and just not verbally.
Yeah, I've had that problem as well. My wife has called me on it. I have friends called me on it. And audiences have called me on it. Producers have called me on it. And I always kind of thought I was funny and being sarcastic and throwing it back at them. And I realized it looked just whiny and bitchy.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had to stop myself. I don't do it as much as I used to, and I have a higher tolerance for a quieter audience.
Sure.
But after a while, even it starts to get on me, and I'm going, come on, I've worked hard on this. At least applaud or clap mm-hmm. or you know, laugh or something. What gets me is when I bring a little kid on stage and I say, and I'm telling the kid so the audience can hear me, they're going to go nuts for you.
Oh.
And then the audience is somewhat, you know, quiet with that. And I look at the crowd, jokingly angry. I say, kid on stage, go nuts for the kid on stage. And then they kind of go, oh, yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And A, yes, that does still make me angry. But B, I have to think to myself, well, if they don't want to clap that much for a kid, they're just not that type sure. to clap. They still might be having a wonderful time
mm-hmm.
and let it go. And, you know,
I did the Castle in May, and I had some friends come to a show who had seen me many times, but very supportive guys. And I had a kind of a bigger agent in the audience. And I was like, hey, you know, just have fun, because I really wanted to make a good impression. And it was like, you know how the audiences at the Castle are. They're always pretty good. And this one was just awful. And by the end, my buddy came up to me. He's like, yeah, I could tell you weren't happy with that. I'm like, oh, shit.
that sucks it came across. I was hoping it didn't come across, but clearly it was obvious that I wanted to kill myself.
But I want you want to stop the crowd and go, everybody, there's an agent in here to see me. And you all know how that feels, 45 right?
45 minutes prior, I killed.
Right, yeah. And yeah, no, I'm human. I mean, I agree we should not get angry on stage. And I also agree that we are human and it's easier said than done.
Mm-hmm. I find it, I get angry on stage if I'm hitting some sort of a performance fatigue, or I've done too many shows in that particular week, or I'll have like a break of no shows and I'll do a butt ton at the same time. And by the end of that, that's when it's easier for me to get ticked off at people. Yeah. So that's something I've had to learn and
Well, and at control. The Castle, we're so spoiled. Usually their worst crowds are still pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, when you truly get a really bad one or a drunk person who's mm-hmm. just disrupting everything or something, then it's that much of more of a shock that it's happening that you really get pissed. On a cruise ship, if they're quiet, all right, a lot of them are quiet on cruise ships.
Yeah, just older
it's
people.
Fine. Yeah. Get through it, and then they'll come compliment you later when you're at the pool. But, yeah, at the Castle, it's even harder because they're usually so good.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's a good way to end. That's good. Thank you for doing this free podcast.
Thanks
for
having
me. Nice of you.
Wait, it's free?
You get paid in hugs.
Oh yeah. Oh, you did tell me that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm good. thank you for having me.
Yeah, this is great. Hey, if you like the podcast, rate us on iTunes. Give us 5 stars. If you didn't like the podcast, don't
screw off then.
I am at Nick Paul Magic. Simon, who's not here today, he's at Things by Simon. Are you on the social medias?
I'm on the Twitters and the Facebooks. I'm Twitter is at Eric C. Bus. C is in the letter C.
Somebody stole
initial.
Eric Bus sold
Somebody
the actual name.
Eric Bus, yep. And then Facebook is Eric Bus Magic.
Cool.
On Facebook.
Cool. Check that out and check out all your
Instagram
videos.
Or any of the others.
Are your Letterman videos and stuff up on your site, or is that should they go to YouTube for that?
Yes, on my site it is a montage, and on YouTube is everything individual.
Cool.
Don't
read the comments. That's the devil. You got to leave the comments on so people see it, and then you get all the racist and angry people leaving comments. It's like, come on, YouTube, figure out something.
Yep.
Anyway, everybody have a nice day. Thanks so much.
Yay.